This is disc number 7.
"You look very beautiful with your hair up," Gabriel had said. "This would be our signal if you see a man you think is Bin Shafiq." "And what happens then?" "Leave that to us, Sarah." Chapter 25. Gustavia, St. Barthélemy. That night, for the first time since boarding Alexandra, Sarah did not sleep. She lay in the large bed, forcing herself to remain motionless so that Bin Talal, if he was watching her through concealed cameras, would not suspect her of a restless conscience. Shortly before 6, the sky began to grow light, and a red stain appeared above the horizon. She waited another half hour before ordering coffee. When it came, she had a pounding headache. She went onto the sun deck and stood at the rail, her gaze on the light slowly coming up in the harbor, her thoughts on Alain Al-Nasser of Montreal. They had remained at his villa a little more than an hour, then had driven to Gustavia for dinner. Zizi had taken over a restaurant called La Vela on the edge of the harbor. Alain Al-Nasser had not come with them. Indeed, his name had not been mentioned at dinner, at least not within earshot of Sarah. A man who might have been Ellie Lavon had strolled past the restaurant during dessert. Sarah had looked down to dab her lips on her napkin, and when she had looked up again, he had vanished. She felt a sudden craving for physical movement, and decided to go to the gym before it was commandeered by Zizi. She pulled on a pair of spandex shorts, a tank top, and her running shoes, then went into the bathroom and pinned up her hair in front of the mirror. The gym, when she arrived, was in silence. She had expected to find it empty, but instead saw Jean-Michel hunched over an apparatus working on his biceps. She greeted him coolly and mounted the treadmill.
"I'm going to the island for a real run. Care to join me?"
"What about Zizi's workout?"
"He says his back is sore."
"Sounds as though you don't believe him."
"His back is always sore whenever he wants a day off."
He finished his set and wiped his glistening arms with a towel.
"Let's go before the traffic gets too heavy."
They boarded a launch and set out toward the inner harbor. There was no wind yet, and the waters were still calm. Jean-Michel tied up at a public dock near an empty café that was just opening for breakfast. They stretched for a few moments on the quay, then set out through the quiet streets of the old town. Jean-Michel moved effortlessly beside her. As they started the twisting ascent up the hillside behind the port, Sarah fell a few paces behind. A motor scooter overtook her, ridden by a helmeted girl in blue jeans with shapely hips. She pushed herself harder and closed the gap. At the top of the hill, she stopped to catch her breath while Jean-Michel jogged lightly in place.
"What's wrong?"
"I've gained nearly 10 pounds on this trip."
"It's nearly over."
"How much longer are we staying?"
2 more days in St. Bart."
He pulled his lips down in a typically Gallic expression.
"Maybe 3. Zizi is getting anxious to leave, I can tell."
Just then, the first flight of the day swept low over their heads and plunged down the opposite side of the hill toward the runway below. Without warning, Jean-Michel started down the road after it. They ran past the airport and the island's main shopping center, then rounded a bend in the road and started toward Saint-Jean village. The first traffic began to appear. Twice they had to leap onto the sandy shoulder of the road to avoid approaching trucks. Jean-Michel led her through an opening in the stone wall at the edge of the road and down a sandy pathway to the beach.
"It's better if we run here," he said. "I'm going to do a couple of fast intervals. Do you think you can stay out of trouble?"
"What makes you think I can't keep up with you?" He lengthened his stride. Sarah struggled to keep pace with him.
"The interval is about to begin," he said. "Are you ready?"
"I thought this was the interval." Jean-Michel sprinted away. Sarah, exhausted from her sleepless night, slowed to a walk, reveling in the fact that for the first time since entering Zizi's camp she was alone. It did not last long. 2 minutes later, Jean-Michel came sprinting back toward her, arms pumping like pistons. Sarah turned and started running again. Jean-Michel overtook her and slowed his pace.
"I'm famished," she said. "How about some breakfast?"
"First, we finish the run. We'll have something at that café next to the boat.
It took them 20 minutes to cover the distance back to the harbor. The café was beginning to fill by the time they arrived, but Jean-Michel found an empty table outside in the shade and sat down. Sarah looked over the menu for a few moments, then lifted her gaze toward the men's clothing boutique opposite the café. The window display was filled with handmade French dress shirts of expensive-looking cotton. Sarah closed the menu and looked at Jean-Michel.
I should buy Zizi a thank-you present.
The last thing Zizi needs is a gift. He truly is the man who has everything.
I should get him something. He was very generous to me.
I'm sure he was.
She touched Jean-Michel's arm and pointed to the boutique.
The last thing Zizi needs is another shirt, he said.
They're very nice looking, though.
Jean-Michel nodded.
The French, he said. We still can do a few things well.
Give me your credit card.
It's an AAB company card.
I'll reimburse you.
He produced a card from the pocket of his running shorts and handed it over.
Don't bother paying me back, he said. Trust me, Sarah. You won't be the first person to buy Zizi a present with his own money.
What size shirt does he wear?
16½ neck, 33 sleeve.
Very impressive.
I'm his personal trainer.
She gave Jean-Michel her breakfast order, tartin, scrambled eggs, and café au lait, then walked over to the boutique. She stood outside for a moment, gazing at the shirts in the window, then slipped through the entrance. An attractive young woman with short blonde hair greeted her in French. Sarah selected two shirts, one dark blue, the other pale yellow, and gave the woman Zizi's measurements. The woman disappeared into a back room and returned a moment later with the shirts.
Do you have a gift box?
Of course, madame.
She produced one from beneath the counter, then carefully wrapped the shirts in tissue paper and placed them inside.
Do you have a gift card of some sort? Sarah asked.
Something with an envelope.
Again, the woman reached beneath the counter. She placed the card before Sarah and handed her a pen.
How will you be paying, madame?
Sarah gave her the credit card. While the saleswoman rang up the purchases, Sarah leaned over the gift card and wrote,
Alain Alnasser, Montreal.
Then she inserted the card into the envelope, licked the adhesive flap, and sealed it tightly. The saleswoman then placed the credit card receipt in front of Sarah. She signed it, then handed the woman the pen, along with the sealed envelope.
I don't understand, madame.
Sometime this morning, a friend of mine is going to come here to see whether I forgot something, Sarah said. Please give my friend this envelope. If you do, you'll be paid handsomely. Discretion is important. Do you understand me, madame?
Of course.
She smiled at Sarah mischievously.
I'm French.
She looked at Jean-Michel sitting in the café.
Buying gifts for your lover with your husband's credit card? Very daring, madame.
Your secret is safe with me.
The woman placed the gift box with the shirts in a paper bag and handed it to Sarah. Sarah winked at her, then went out and returned to the café. Her breakfast was waiting for her when she sat down.
Any problems? Jean-Michel asked.
Sarah shook her head and handed him the credit card.
No, she said. No problems at all.
30 minutes later, Sarah and Jean-Michel boarded the launch and returned to Alexandra. Gabriel waited another 15 minutes before entering the boutique. He collected the gift card from the saleswoman and gave her €100 for her trouble. 5 minutes after that, he was seated at the tiller of a Zodiac, heading out of the inner harbor toward the anchorage. Alexandra lay directly before him, by far the largest private vessel in port, second in scale only to the cruise ship that had come in overnight. Gabriel turned a few degrees to port and headed toward Sundancer, which was anchored several hundred yards away near the twin rocks that stood guard over the entrance of the harbor. He tied off the Zodiac at the stern and went into the main salon, which had been converted into a mobile command and operations center. There was a secure satellite telephone and a computer with a link to King Saul Boulevard. 24 cellular phones and several handheld radios stood in formation in their chargers, and a video camera with telephoto lens was trained on Alexandra. Gabriel stood before the monitor and watched Sarah step out onto her private sundeck. Then he looked at Yakov, who was on the phone to Tel Aviv. When Yakov hung up a moment later, Gabriel held up the gift card. Alain Al-Nasser, Montreal.
"That's our girl," Yakov said. "Have a seat, Gabriel. Kingsall Boulevard has had a busy morning."
Gabriel poured himself a cup of coffee from a thermos and sat down.
"Technical hacked into the reservation system of the villa rental firm early this morning," Yakov said. "The villa where Sarah went last night was rented by a company called Meridian Construction of Montreal."
"Meridian Construction is controlled entirely by AAB Holdings," Lavonne said.
"Did the reservation say who would be staying there?" Gabriel asked.
Yakov shook his head.
"The booking was handled by a woman named Catherine Devereaux at Meridian headquarters. She paid for everything in advance and instructed the rental company to have the house open and ready for his arrival."
"When did he get here?"
3 days ago, according to the records."
"How much longer is he staying?"
"The reservation is for 4 more nights.
"What about his car?"
"There's a cabriolet parked at the house now. The sticker on the back says Island Rental Cars. No computerized reservation system. Everything's on paper. If we want the particulars, we'll have to break in the old-fashioned way."
Gabriel looked at Mordecai, a Neviot man by training.
"Their office is at the airport," Mordecai said. "It's nothing more than a booth with a sliding aluminum shutter over the window and one door for the staff to come in and out. We could be inside in a matter of seconds. The problem is that the airport itself is under guard at night. We could lose the entire operation just to find out the name and credit card number he used to rent his car."
"Too risky," Gabriel said.
"Any activity on the telephone?"
Mordecai had placed a transmitter in the junction box last night overnight.
"One call this morning," he said. "A woman. She phoned a hair salon in Saint-Jean and made an appointment for this afternoon."
"What did she call herself?"
"Madame Al-Nasser," Mordecai said. "There's one small problem with the tap. As it stands now, we're at the outside edge of its range. The signal is weak and full of interference. If Bin Shafiq picked up the phone right now, we might not be able to make a voice ID on him because of static on the line. We need a listening post."
Gabriel looked at Yakov.
"What about moving the boat?" "The waters off that point are too rough to be used as an anchorage. If we dropped anchor out there to watch the villa, we'd stick out like a sore thumb. We might as well just walk up to Al-Nasser's front door and introduce ourselves."
"That's not a bad idea," said Mikhail as he entered the salon. "I volunteer."
"We need a static post," Yakov said.
"So we'll get one." Gabriel held up the gift card again.
"What about this name? Do you recognize it?" "It's not an alias that we know about," Yakov said. "I'll have Kingsall Boulevard run it through the computers and see what they come up with."
"What now?" asked Mikhail.
"We'll spend the day watching him," Gabriel said. "We'll try to get his photograph and his voice. If we can, we'll send them to Kingsall Boulevard for analysis."
"It's a small island," Lavonne said, his tone cautionary. "And we have limited personnel."
"That can work to our advantage. In a place like this, it's not uncommon to see the same people every day."
"True," Lavonne said. "But Bin Talal's goons will get nervous if they see too many familiar faces."
"And what if Kingsall Boulevard tells us that Alain Al-Nasser of Montreal is really a Saudi GID officer named Ahmed Bin Shafiq?"
Mikhail asked.
"What do we do then?"
Gabriel glanced up at the monitor and looked at Sarah.
"I'm going back to Gustavia," he said, still gazing at the screen. "We need a listening post."
The well-bred Englishwoman who greeted him 15 minutes later at the Sibarth Villa rental agency had sun-streaked brown hair and pale blue eyes. Gabriel played the role of Heinrich Kiefer, a German of means who had stumbled upon paradise and now wished to stay on a bit longer. The Englishwoman smiled. She had heard many such tales before, then printed out a listing of available properties. Gabriel scanned it and frowned.
I was hoping for something here, he said, tapping the map that lay spread over her desk. On this point on the north side of the island.
Point Milieu? Yes, it's lovely, but I'm afraid we have nothing available there at the moment. We do have something here. She tapped the map. The next point over, Point Manguin.
Can you see Point Milieu from the house?
Yes, quite clearly. Would you like to see some photographs?
Please.
The woman produced a brochure and opened it to the appropriate page.
It's 4 bedrooms, Herr Kiefer. Did you need something that large?
Actually, we might be having some company.
Then I suspect this will do brilliantly. It's a bit pricey, 12,000 a week, and I'm afraid there's a 2-week minimum.
Gabriel shrugged as if to say money was no object.
No children, and absolutely no pets. You don't have a dog, do you?
Heavens, no.
There's a $2,000 security deposit as well, bringing the grand total to $26,000, payable in advance, of course.
When can we have it?
She looked at her watch.
It's 10:15 now. If we rush things along, we should be able to have you and your wife in by 11:30 at the latest.
Gabriel smiled and handed her a credit card. Though the Englishwoman did not know it, the first guests arrived at the villa 15 minutes after Gabriel and Dina had settled in. Their possessions were quite unlike those of ordinary visitors to the island. Mordecai brought a voice-activated receiver and an Nikon camera with a long lens, while Mikhail arrived with a nylon rucksack containing cellular phones, radios, and 4 handguns. An hour later, they glimpsed their quarry for the first time when he strode onto the terrace, dressed in white shorts and a long-sleeved white shirt, and gazed contentedly out to sea. Mordecai snapped several photos of him. 5 minutes later, when Al-Nasser emerged shirtless from the pool after a vigorous swim, he snapped several more. Gabriel examined the images on the computer but deemed them unworthy of sending to King Saul Boulevard for analysis. At 1 in the afternoon, the light on the voice-activated recorder turned from red to green. A burst of tone came over the line, followed by the sound of someone inside the house dialing a local number. After 2 rings, the call was answered by a woman at La Gloriette restaurant. Gabriel closed his eyes in disappointment when the next voice on the line was that of Madame Al-Nasser, requesting a lunch reservation for 2 o'clock. He briefly considered putting a team inside the restaurant, but ruled it out after obtaining a description of the cramped beachside dining room. Mordecai, however, managed to take 2 more photographs of Al-Nasser, one as he was climbing out of his car in the parking lot, and a 2nd as he was sipping a drink at his table. In both, he was wearing dark sports sunglasses and a long-sleeved shirt. Gabriel dispatched them to King Saul Boulevard for analysis. 1 hour later, as Al-Nasser and his wife were leaving the restaurant, King Saul Boulevard sent a flash over the secure link that the results were inconclusive. At 3:30, they departed La Gloriette and drove to Saint-Jean village, where Al-Nasser dropped his wife at the hair salon. From there, he went to Gustavia, where, at 3:50, he boarded a launch and headed to Alexandra. Yossi recorded his arrival from the bridge of Sundancer, along with the warm embrace he received from Zizi al-Bakri as they entered the upstairs office suite for a private meeting. Sarah was not on board to see Al-Nasser's arrival, for at that moment she and most of Zizi's entourage were snorkeling in Il Fourche, a small deserted island about 1 mile northeast of St. Bart's. The meeting lasted a little over 1 hour. Yossi recorded Al-Nasser's departure from Zizi's office and the altogether determined expression on his face as he boarded the launch and headed back to Gustavia. Mikhail followed him back to St. John village, where he collected his newly coiffed wife from the salon shortly after 6 o'clock. By 6:30, Al-Nasser was once again swimming laps in his pool, and Mikhail was seated glumly next to Gabriel in the villa on the other side of the inlet.
"We've been chasing him all day," Mikhail said. "And what have we got to show for it? A few useless pictures. Alain Al-Nasser is obviously Bin Shafiq. Let's take him now and be done with it."
Gabriel gave him a disdainful look.
"Some day, when you're a little older and wiser, I'll tell you a story about the night an office hit team thought they had the prize in their sights and killed an innocent waiter by mistake." I know the story, Gabriel. It happened in Lillehammer. Inside the office you still refer to it as Lillehammer, the night of bitterness. But it was a long time ago. It is still the greatest operational blunder in the history of the office. They killed the wrong man, and they got caught doing it. They broke all the rules, they acted hastily, and they let their emotions get the better of them. We've come too far to have another Lillehammer. First, we get proof. Airtight, unassailable proof that Alain Al-Nasser is Ahmed bin Shafiq. Only then do we start talking about killing him. And we pull the trigger only if we can get Sarah and the entire team off the island without getting caught. How are we going to get proof? The photographs aren't good enough, Gabriel said. We need his voice. He doesn't speak. Everyone speaks. We just have to make him speak while we're listening. And how are you going to do that? Just then, the green light shone on the telephone recorder and a burst of dial tone came blaring over the speakers. Madame Al-Nasser's call lasted less than 30 seconds. When it was over, Gabriel listened to it again just to make certain he'd gotten the details right.
Le Poivre, we'd like a table for 2 at 9 o'clock. We're booked then, madame. I can do 8 or 9:30. 8 is too early. We'll take the 9:30, please. Your name? Al-Nasser.
Gabriel pressed the stop button and looked at Mikhail. Patience, my boy. Good things come to those who wait. The restaurant, known as La Poivre, is one of the island's undiscovered gems. It stands at the far end of a pleasant little shopping center in Saint-Jean, at the intersection of the main coast road and a narrow track that climbs the heights overlooking the beach. It has no view other than the traffic and the parking lot, and little in the way of ambiance. The dining room is the size of an average suburban patio. The service is sometimes listless, but the food, when it finally arrives, is always among the best on the island. Still, because of its unremarkable location, those who come to Saint-Barth's to be seen are rarely seen at La Poivre, and nothing much out of the ordinary ever happens there. It is why, to this day, they still talk about the incident that occurred there involving Monsieur and Madame Al-Nasser. The staff know the story well, as do the locals who drink pastis at the tiny bar. Afternoons, during the docile period between lunch and the evening rush, they often recount it over a glass of rosé or an espresso and a cigarette. The reservation had been for 9:30, but they had come on the early side. Odette, the hostess on duty that night, remembers it as 9:15, but Etienne, the bartender, will tell you with great certainty that it was 9:20. There were no tables yet available, and so they had a seat at the bar to wait. Etienne salted the drinks, of course, a glass of champagne for Madame Al-Nasser, a pineapple juice for the gentleman. "Nothing else?" Etienne had asked. But the gentleman had smiled without charm, and in a voice barely above a whisper had replied, "Just the juice, please." A table opened sometime after 9:30. Again, there is a mild dispute over the time. Denise, the waitress, recalls it as 9:40, but Odette, keeper of the reservation sheet and watcher of the clock, swears it was no later than 9:35. Regardless of the time, Monsieur and Madame Al-Nasser were not happy with the table. Madame complained that it was too close to the entrance of the toilet, but one had the impression that Monsieur Al-Nasser disliked the table for a different reason, though he never voiced an opinion. It was nearly 10 before the next table opened. This one was against the rail overlooking the street. Monsieur Al-Nasser sat in the chair facing the bar, but Etienne remembers that his gaze was fixed permanently on the traffic flowing along the coast road. Denise surprised them of the evening's menu and took their drink orders. Madame ordered a bottle of wine, Côte de Rhône, says Denise, Bordeaux, according to Etienne. Of the wine's color, however, there is no dispute. It was red, and much of it would soon be splashed across Madame's white tropical pantsuit. The catalyst for the incident arrived at La Poivre at 10:15. He was small of stature and unimpressive of build. Etienne made him at 5'8", 150 pounds at the most. He wore a pair of baggy khaki shorts that hadn't been washed in some time, an oversized gray t-shirt with a tear in the left sleeve, a pair of reefer sandals with Velcro straps, and a golf cap that had seen better days.
Strangely, no one can summon a compelling portrait of his face. Etienne remembers a pair of outdated eyeglasses. Odette recalls an untrimmed mustache that really didn't suit his features. Denise only remembers the walk. His legs had a slight outward bend to them, she will tell you, like a man who can run very fast or is good at football. He had no name that night, but later would come to be known simply as Claude. He had come to Saint-Jean by motorbike from the direction of Gustavia, and had spent the better part of the evening drinking Heineken at the bar a few doors down. When he arrived at 10:15 looking for a table, his breath stank of cigarettes and hops, and his body didn't smell much better. When Odette explained that there were no tables, and that I wouldn't seat him if we had one, he mumbled something unintelligible and asked for the key to the toilet, to which Odette replied that the toilet was for paying customers only. He then looked at Etienne and said, "Heineken." Etienne put a bottle on the bar, shrugged at Odette, and handed him the key. How long he remained inside is also a matter of some dispute. Estimates range from 2 minutes to five, and wild theories have been spun as to exactly what he was doing in there. The poor couple seated at the table rejected by Monsieur and Madame Elnasser later described his piss as one for the ages, and said it was followed by much flushing and running of water into the basin. When finally he emerged, he was pulling at the fly of his khaki shorts and smiling like a man relieved of a great burden. He started back toward the bar, with his gaze targeted squarely upon the waiting Heineken, and then the trouble began. Denise had just finished refilling Madame Alnasser's glass of wine. Madame was raising it for a drink, but lowered it in disgust as Claude came out of the toilet tugging at his crotch. Unfortunately, she placed the glass on the table and released it in order to lean forward and tell Monsieur Alnasser about the spectacle. As Claude teetered past, his hand knocked against the glass, spilling its contents into the lap of Madame Alnasser. Accounts of what transpired next vary according to who is telling the story. All agree Claude made what appeared to be a good-faith attempt to apologize, and all agree that it was Monsieur Alnasser who chose the path of escalation. Harsh words were exchanged, as were threats of violence. The incident might have resolved peacefully had not Claude offered to pay the dry-cleaning bill. When the offer was hotly refused, he reached into the pocket of his soiled khaki shorts and hurled a few wrinkled euro notes into Monsieur Alnasser's face. Denise managed to get out of the way just before Monsieur Alnasser seized Claude by the throat and pushed him toward the exit. He held him there for a moment, shouting more insults into his face, then pushed him down the steps into the street. There was a smattering of applause from the other patrons and much concern about the wretched state of Madame Alnasser's garments. Only Etienne bothered to tend to the figure sprawled on the pavement. He helped the man to his feet and, with serious reservations, watched as he mounted his motorbike and wobbled down the coast road. To this day, Etienne harbors doubts about the authenticity of that evening's events. A black belt in karate, he saw something in the drunkard's carriage that told him he was a fellow student of the arts. Had the little man in the glasses and golf hat chosen to fight back, Etienne says with the conviction of one who knows, he could have torn Monsieur Elnasser's arm from the socket and served it to him for dinner with his Bordeaux.
"It wasn't Bordeaux," Denise will tell you. "It was Coderon."
"Coderon, Bordeaux. It doesn't matter. And I'll tell you something else. When that little bastard drove away, he was grinning from ear to ear, like he just won the lotto."
Elie Lavon had watched Gabriel's performance from the parking lot, and so it was Lavon who described it for the rest of the team that evening at the villa. Gabriel was slowly pacing the tiled floor, nursing a club soda for his hangover, and holding a bag of ice to a swollen left elbow. His thoughts were on the scene now taking place half a world away in Tel Aviv, where a team of specialists in the science of voice identification was deciding whether the man known as Alain Alnasser would live or die. Gabriel knew what the answer would be. He had known it the instant his quarry had risen from his table in a killing rage, and he had seen proof of it a few seconds later when he'd managed to lift the right sleeve of his quarry's shirt and sneak a glance at the ugly shrapnel scar on his forearm. At 11:30, the lights came on in the villa across the inlet. Gabriel went out onto the terrace, and on the opposite point,
Ahmed bin Shafiq did the same. To Mikael, it seemed that the two men were staring at each other over the darkened divide. At 11:35, the satellite phone purred softly. Yakov answered it, listened a moment in silence, then rang off and called Gabriel inside. Chapter 26. Point Manguin, Saint-Barthélemy. They gathered in the open-air living room of the villa and sprawled on the sailcloth couches and wicker chairs. Dina made the first pot of coffee, while Lavon taped a large-scale map of the island onto the wall. Gabriel stared at it gloomily for a long time in silence. When finally he spoke, he uttered a single word. Zoeter. Then he looked at Lavon. Do you remember Zoeter, Ellie? Lavon raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. Of course Lavon remembered Zoeter, chief of Black September in Italy, first to die for Munich. Gabriel could almost see him now, a skinny intellectual in a plaid jacket, crossing the Piazza Annibaliano in Rome with a bottle of fig wine in one hand and a copy of A Thousand and One Nights in the other. How long did you watch him, Ellie? 2 weeks?
Nearly three.
Tell them what you learned about Wadal Zoeter before we even thought about killing him.
That he stopped each evening in the same small market, that he always went to the Trieste bar to make a few phone calls, and that he always went into his apartment building through entrance C, that the lights in the foyer operated on a timer, and that he always stood in the dark for a moment, searching his pockets for a 10-lira coin to operate the lift. That's why you did it, wasn't it, Gabriel? In front of the lift?
Excuse me, but are you Wadal Zoeter?
No. Please, no.
And then you vanished, Lavon continued. Two escape cars, a team to cover the route. By morning you were in Switzerland. Chamron said it was like blowing out a match. We controlled every detail. We chose the time and the place of the execution and planned it down to the smallest detail. We did everything right that night, but we can't do any of those things on this island. Gabriel looked at the map. We operate best in cities, not places like this.
That might be true, said Dina, but you can't let him leave here alive.
Why not?
Because he has the resources of a billionaire at his fingertips. Because he can fly off to the Najd at a moment's notice and be lost to us forever.
There are right ways to do these things, and there are wrong ways. This is definitely the wrong way.
Don't be afraid to pull the trigger because of what happened at the Gare de Lyon, Gabriel.
This has nothing to do with Paris. We have a professional target, a small battlefield, a haphazard escape route, and an unpredictable variable named Sarah Bancroft. Shall I go on?
But Dina is right, Yossi said. We have to do it now. We might never get another shot at him.
The 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. That's our first responsibility. Everything else is secondary.
Did you see him aboard Zizi's yacht today? Ramona asked. Shall we watch the tape again? Did you see his face when he came out? What do you think they were talking about, Gabriel? Investments? He tried to kill my uncle. He has to die.
What would we do about the woman? Yossi asked.
She's an accomplice, Lavon said. She's obviously part of his network. Why is her voice the only one we hear? Doesn't she find it a bit odd that her husband never picks up the phone?
So do we kill her?
If we don't, we'll never make it off this island.
Dina suggested they put the entire operation to a vote. Yakov shook his head.
In case you haven't noticed, he said, this is not a democracy.
Gabriel looked at Lavon. The two held each other's gaze for a moment, then Lavon closed his eyes and nodded once. They did not sleep that night. In the morning, Yossi rented a second Suzuki Vitara four-wheel drive, while Yakov and Ramona each rented Piaggio motorbikes. Oded and Mordecai went to a marine supply outlet in Gustavia and purchased two Zodiacs with outboard engines. Dina spent much of that day calling the island's most exclusive restaurants, trying to book a table for 30. At 1:30, she learned that Le Tetu, a trendy beachside restaurant in Saint-Jean, had already been booked that evening for a private party and would not be open to the public. Gabriel rode into Saint-Jean to have a look for himself. The restaurant was an open-air structure with swatches of colorful cloth hanging from the ceiling and ear-shattering dance music blaring from the speakers. A dozen tables stood beneath a peaked wooden shelter, and several more were scattered along the beach. There was a small bar and, like many restaurants on the island, a boutique that sold atrociously expensive women's beachwear. Lunch service had reached fever pitch, and barefoot girls clad only in bikini tops and ankle-length beach dresses rushed from table to table dispensing food and drink. A feline-looking bathing suit model emerged from the boutique and posed for him. When Gabriel gave no sign of approval, the girl frowned and moved on to a table of well-lubricated Americans who bayed in approval. He walked over to the bar and ordered a glass of rosé, then carried it over to the boutique. The changing rooms and toilets were down a narrow passage, at the end of which was the parking lot. He stood there for a moment, visualizing movement, calculating time. Then he swallowed half of the rosé and went out. It was perfect, he thought. But there was one problem. Snatching Sarah from a table was out of the question. Zizi's bodyguards were heavily armed and, to a man, were all former officers of the Saudi National Guard. To get Sarah cleanly, they had to move her into the changing rooms at a prearranged time, and to do that they would have to get her a message. As Gabriel rode off on his motorbike, he called Lavonne at the villa and asked whether she was on the island. The restaurant at Celine has no view of the sea, only of the sand dunes and a broad salt marsh framed by scrub-covered green hills. Sarah sat on the shaded veranda, her fingers wrapped around the stem of a wine glass filled with icy rosé. Next to her sat Nadia, the modern Muslim woman, who was working on her third daiquiri and improving in mood with each passing minute. On the opposite side of the table, Monique and Jean-Michel were silently quarreling. The Frenchman's eyes were concealed behind a pair of dark wraparound sunglasses, but Sarah could see he was scrutinizing the young couple who had just arrived on a motorbike and were now tramping up the stairs to the veranda. The man was tall and lanky, clad in knee-length swimming trunks, flip-flops, and a cotton pullover. His English accent betrayed an Oxbridge education, as did the imperious manner in which he inquired about the availability of a table. The girl's accent was indeterminate Middle European. Her bikini top was still wet from her swim and clung suggestively to a pair of generous, suntanned breasts. She asked the hostess about the location of the toilet, loudly enough for Sarah and everyone else in the restaurant to hear, then calmly held Jean-Michel's gaze as she walked past the table, her emerald beach wrap flowing from a pair of child-bearing hips. Nadia sucked at her daiquiri, while Monique scowled at Jean-Michel, as if she suspected his interest in the girl extended beyond the professional. 2 minutes later, when the girl emerged, she was fussing with her hair and swaying playfully to the reggae music issuing from the stereo behind the bar. Office doctrine, thought Sarah. When operating in public places like bars and restaurants, don't sit quietly or read a magazine. That only makes you look like a spy. Call attention to yourself. Flirt, be loud, drink too much. A quarrel is always nice. But there was something else Sarah noticed that she was sure Jean-Michel had not. Ramona was wearing no earrings, which meant she had left a message for Sarah inside the toilet. Sarah watched as Ramona sat down next to Yossi and snapped at him for not having a drink waiting for her. A line of clouds was coming over the dunes, and a sudden wind was chasing in the marsh grass.
"Looks like a big storm," said Jean-Michel, and he ordered a third bottle of rosé to help ride it out.
Nadia lit a Virginia Slims, then gave the pack to Monique, who did the same. Sarah turned to watch the approaching storm. All the while she was thinking of the clock and wondering how many minutes she should let pass before she went to the bathroom, and what she might find when she went there. 5 minutes later, the clouds opened, and a gust of wind hurled rain against Sarah's back. Jean-Michel signaled the waitress and asked her to lower the awning. Sarah stood, seized her beach bag, and started toward the back of the restaurant.
"Where are you going?" asked Jean-Michel.
"We're working on our third bottle of wine. Where do you think I'm going?"
He stood suddenly and followed after her.
This is very thoughtful of you, but I really don't need your help. I've been doing this sort of thing alone since I was a little girl.
He took her by the arm and led her to the restroom. The door was ajar. He pushed it all the way open, looked quickly around, then stepped aside and allowed her to enter. Sarah closed the door and bolted it, then dropped the toilet seat, loudly enough so that it could be heard beyond the door.
"We have several places we like to hide things," Gabriel had told her. "Taped to the inside of the toilet tank, or hidden inside the seat-covered dispenser. Rubbish bins are always good, especially if they have a lid. We like to hide messages inside tampon boxes because we've found that Arab men, even professionals, are loath to touch them."
She looked beneath the sink, saw an aluminum canister, and put her foot on the pedal. When the lid rose, she saw the box, partially concealed by crumpled paper towels. She reached down and plucked it out.
"Read the message quickly," Gabriel had said. "Trust yourself to remember the details. Never, I mean, never take the message with you. We like to use flash paper, so if you have a lighter or matches, set it on fire in the sink and it will disappear. If not, flush it down the toilet. Worst case, put it back in the box and leave it in the trash. We'll clean it out after you leave."
Sarah looked in her beach bag and saw she had a book of matches. She started to take them out, but decided she didn't have the nerve for it, so she tore the message to bits and flushed them down the toilet. She stood before the mirror a moment and examined her face while she ran water into the basin. "You're Sarah Bancroft," she told herself. "You don't know the woman who left the tampon box in the trash. You've never seen her before." She shut off the taps and returned to the veranda. Rainwater was now spilling over the gutters in torrents. Yossi was in the process of noisily sending back a bottle of Sancerre, which he swore had gone bad. Ramona was examining the menu as though she found it of little interest, and Jean-Michel was watching her coming across the room as though seeing her for the first time. She sat down and watched the storm rolling across the marsh, knowing it would soon be over. "You're having dinner at Le Tetu tonight," the message had said. "When you see us, pretend to be ill and go to the bathroom. Don't worry if they send a bodyguard. We'll take care of him." All they needed now was the guest of honor. For much of that day, they did not see him. Gabriel grew concerned that Bin Shafiq had somehow managed to slip away undetected and briefly considered placing a phone call to the villa to make certain it was still occupied. But at 11:30, they saw him emerge onto the terrace, where, after his customary vigorous swim, he sunned himself for an hour. At 12:30, he went inside again, and a few minutes later, the white cabriolet came rolling down the drive with the top down and the woman behind the wheel. She drove to a charcuterie in Lorient village, spent 10 minutes inside, then returned to the villa on Pointe Milou for an al fresco lunch. At 3 o'clock, as the storm was breaking over the coast, the cabriolet again came down the drive, but this time it was Bin Shafiq behind the wheel. Lavon set off after him on one of the newly acquired scooters, with Mordecai and Oded following in support. It quickly became apparent the Saudi was checking for surveillance, because he forsook the crowded roads along the northern coast of the island and headed instead toward the sparsely developed eastern shore. He sped along the rocky coastline of Twani, then turned inland and raced through a string of scruffy hamlets in the grassy hills of the Grand Fond. He paused for a few seconds at the turnoff for Lorient, long enough so that Mordecai had to come around him. 2 minutes later, at the intersection of the road to Saint-Jean, he engaged in the same time-tested routine. This time it was Oded who had to abandon the chase. Lavon was convinced that Bin Shafiq's ultimate destination was Gustavia. He hurried into town by a different route and was waiting near the Carl Gustav Hotel when the cabriolet came down the hill from Lorient. The Saudi parked along the edge of the harbor. 10 minutes later, after making another careful check of his tail, this one on foot, he joined Wazir bin Talal at a quayside café. Lavon had sushi at a restaurant up the street and waited them out. An hour later, he was back at the villa telling Gabriel they had a problem.
"Why is he meeting with Bin Talal?" "Bin Talal is security, Zizi's security. We have to consider the possibility that Sarah's already blown. We've been operating in close proximity for several days now. It's a small island.
We're all professionals, but...
Lavone's voice trailed off.
But what?
Zizi's boys are professionals, too. And so is Bin Shafiq. He was driving this afternoon like a man who knew he was being followed.
It's standard procedure, said Gabriel, playing the devil's advocate without much enthusiasm.
You can always tell the difference between someone who's going through the motions and someone who thinks he's got a watcher on his tail. It feels to me like Bin Shafiq knows he's being watched.
So what are you suggesting, Ellie? Call it off?
No, Lavone said. But if we can only get one target tonight, make sure it's Sarah.
10 minutes later, the green light, the burst of dial tone, the sound of a number being dialed.
La Terrazza? I'd like to make a reservation for this evening, please. How many in your party? 2. What time? 9 o'clock. Can you hold a moment while I check the book? Sure. Would 9:15 be all right? Yes, of course. All right, we have a reservation for 2 at 9:15. Your name, please. Al-Nasser. Merci, madame. Au revoir.
Click. Gabriel walked over to the map.
La Terrazza is here, he said, tapping his finger against the hills above Saint-Jean. They won't have to leave the villa until 9 at the earliest.
Unless they go somewhere first, said Lavone.
Zizi's dinner begins at 8. That gives us almost an hour before we would have to move Sarah into place for the extraction.
Unless Zizi arrives late, said Lavone.
Gabriel walked over to the window and looked across the inlet. The weather had broken, and it was now dusk. The sea was beginning to grow dark, and lights were coming on in the hills.
We'll kill them at the villa, inside the house or behind the walls in the drive.
Them? Asked Lavone.
It's the only way we'll get off the island, Gabriel said. The woman has to die too.
Chapter 27. Gustavia Harbor, San Bartolomé. In the 2 hours that followed Gabriel's declaration, there took place a quiet movement of personnel and materiel that went largely unnoticed by the island's docile population. Sarah was witness to only one element of the preparations, for she was seated on her private deck, wrapped in a white terry robe, as Sundancer got underway and receded silently into the gathering darkness. The gusty winds of the afternoon had died away, and there was only a gentle, warm breeze chasing around the yachts anchored at the mouth of the harbor. Sarah closed her eyes. She had a headache from the sun, and her mouth tasted of nickel from too much rosé. She latched onto her discomfort. It gave her something to dwell on besides what lay ahead. She glanced at her wristwatch, the Harry Winston wristwatch that had been given to her by the chairman and CEO of Jihad Incorporated. It read 7:20. She was almost home. She looked toward Alexandra's stern and saw that the Sikorsky was darkened and motionless. They were going ashore by launch tonight, departure scheduled for 7:45, arrangements having been made by Hassan, ever-efficient chief of ZZ's travel department.
"And please don't be late, Miss Sarah," Hassan had told her.
ZZ had advised her to wear something special.
"Le Tetu is my favorite restaurant on the island," ZZ had said. "It promises to be a memorable evening."
The breeze rose, and from somewhere in the harbor came the clanging of a buoy. She gave another glance at her watch and saw it was 7:25. She allowed herself to picture a reunion. Perhaps they would have a family meal, like the meals they had shared together in the manor house in Surrey that did not exist. Or perhaps the circumstances would be such that food was not appropriate. Whatever the mood, she craved their embrace. She loved them. She loved all of them. She loved them because everyone else hated them. She loved them because they were an island of sanity surrounded by a sea of zealots, and because she feared that the tide of history might one day sweep them away, and she wanted to be a part of them, if only for a moment. She loved their hidden pain and their capacity for joy, their lust for life and their contempt for those who murdered innocents. To each of their lives was attached a purpose, and to Sarah each seemed a small miracle. She thought of Dina, scarred, beautiful Dina, the last of 6 children, 1 child for each 1,000,000 murdered. Her father, she had told Sarah, had been the only member of his family to survive the Holocaust. After coming to Israel, he had chosen the name Sarid, which in Hebrew means remnant, and he had named his last child Dina, which means avenged. "I'm Dina Sarid," she had said. "I'm the avenged remnant." "And tonight," thought Sarah, "we stand together." 7:30, and still she did not move from her chair on the deck. Her procrastination had purpose. She wanted to give herself only a few minutes to dress, less time to send an inadvertent signal that she had no intention of coming back. "Bring nothing with you," Ramona's message had said. "Leave your room in a mess." And so she remained on the deck another 5 minutes before rising and entering her cabin. She let the robe slide from her shoulders and fall to the floor, then quickly pulled on underpants and a bra. Her clothing, a loose-fitting saffron-colored pantsuit that Nadia had bought for her the previous afternoon in Gustavia, was laid out on the unmade bed. She pulled it on quickly and went to the vanity in the bathroom. She slipped on the gold bangle but left the rest of the jewelry Zizi had given her on the counter. When deciding how to wear her hair, she hesitated for the first time. Up or down? Down, she decided. The first step back toward her old life. A life that Gabriel had warned would never be the same. She went back into the room and took one last look around. "Leave your room in a mess." Mission accomplished. "Bring nothing with you." No handbag or wallet, no credit cards or money. But then who needs credit cards and money when one is attached to the entourage of Zizi al-Bakri? She went out into the corridor and closed the door, making certain it was unlocked. Then she headed to the stern, where the launches were waiting. Rafik handed her aboard to Jean-Michel, and she squeezed between the Abduls in the aft seating compartment. Zizi was opposite her, next to Nadia. As the boat started toward shore, they were eyeing her intently in the darkness.
"You should have worn your pearls, Sarah. They would have gone nicely with your pantsuit, but I'm pleased to see your hair is down again. It looks much nicer that way. I never liked you with your hair up."
He looked at Nadia.
"Don't you think she looks better with her hair down?"
But before Nadia could answer, Hassan pressed an open cell phone into Zizi's palm and murmured something in Arabic that sounded frightfully urgent. Sarah looked toward the inner harbor, where 4 black Toyota Land Cruisers waited at the edge of the quay. A small cluster of onlookers had gathered, hoping to catch a glimpse of the celebrity who could command such an impressive motorcade on so small an island. The dark-haired girl, seated beneath the shelter of a gazebo 50 yards away, couldn't be bothered by the spectacle of celebrity. The avenged remnant was gazing off into space, her mind obviously wrestling with more weighty matters. The beach at Saline, one of the few on the island to have no hotels or villas, was dark except for the phosphorus glow of the breakers and the bright moonlight. Mordecai brought the first Zodiac ashore at 8:05. Oded came 2 minutes later, piloting his own Zodiac and towing a third by a nylon line. At 8:10, they signaled Gabriel. Team Saline was in place. The escape hatch was now open. As usual, the beach at Saint-Jean had been slow to empty that evening, and there were still a few steadfast souls sitting in the sand in the gathering darkness. At the end of the airport runway, near a weather-beaten sign that warned of low-flying aircraft, a small party was underway. They were 4 in number, 3 men and a dark-haired girl who had arrived by motor scooter from Gustavia a few moments earlier. One of them had brought some Heineken beer, another a small portable CD player, which was now playing a bit of Bob Marley. The 3 men were laying about in various states of relaxation. 2 of them, a tough-looking man with pockmarked skin and a gentle soul with quick brown eyes and flyaway hair, were chain-smoking for their nerves. The girl was dancing to the music, her white blouse glowing softly in the moonlight. Though it was not evident in their demeanor, they had taken great care in choosing the location for their party. From their position, they could monitor traffic on the road from Gustavia, along with the large private dinner party, now beginning about 100 yards down the beach at Le Tetu restaurant. At 8:30, one of the men, the tough one with a pockmarked face, appeared to receive a call on his mobile phone. It was not an ordinary phone, but a two-way radio capable of sending and receiving secure transmissions. A moment after hanging up, he and the other two men got to their feet and made their way noisily back to the road, where they climbed into a Suzuki Vitara and headed for the restaurant. The girl dressed in white remained behind on the beach, listening to Bob Marley. As she watched a private turboprop plane descending low over the waters of the bay toward the runway, she looked at the weather-beaten sign, "Beware of low-flying aircraft." The girl was dissident by nature and paid it no heed. She turned up the volume of the music and danced as the plane roared over her head. The beach at Marigot Bay is small and rocky and rarely used except by locals as a place to store their boats. There is a small turnoff just off the coast road with room for two or three cars and a flight of rickety wood stairs leading down to the beach. On that night, the turnout was occupied by a pair of Piaggio motorbikes. Their owners were on the darkened beach, perched on the belly of an overturned rowboat. Both had nylon rucksacks at their feet, and both rucksacks contained two silent handguns. The younger man carried .45 caliber Barak SP-21s. The older man preferred smaller weapons, and had always been partial to Italian guns. The weapons in his bag were 9mm Berettas. Unlike their compatriots at Saint-Jean, the two men were not drinking or listening to music, or engaging in false gaiety of any kind. Both were silent, and both were taking slow and steady breaths to calm their racing hearts. The older man was watching the traffic along the road. The younger man was contemplating the gentle surf. Both, however, were picturing the scene that would take place in a few minutes in the villa at the end of the point. At 8:30, the older one raised his radio to his lips and uttered two words, "Go, Dina." It was Monique, Jean-Michel's wife, who spotted the girl first. Drinks had just been served. Zizi had just finished ordering everyone to enjoy the meal, because it was to be their last on St. Bart's. Sarah was seated at the opposite end of the table next to Herr Verli. The Swiss banker was discussing his admiration for the work of Ernst Ludwig Kirchner when Sarah, from the corner of her eye, noticed the swift turn of Monique's angular head and the supple movement of her dark hair.
"There's that girl," Monique said to no one in particular. "The one with the terrible scar on her leg. Remember her, Sarah? We saw her on the beach at Celine yesterday. Thank God she's wearing pants tonight."
Sarah politely disengaged herself from the Swiss banker and followed Monique's gaze. The girl was walking along the water's edge, dressed in a white blouse and blue jeans rolled up to her calves. As she approached the restaurant, one of the bodyguards came forward and tried to block her path. Sarah, though she could not hear their conversation, could see the girl exerting her right to walk along a public stretch of beach, regardless of the high-security private party taking place at Le Tetu. Office doctrine, she thought. Don't try to appear inconspicuous. Make a spectacle of yourself. The bodyguard finally relented, and the girl limped slowly past and vanished into the darkness. Sarah allowed another moment to elapse, then leaned across the table in front of Monique and spoke quietly into Jean-Michel's ear.
"I think I'm about to be sick."
"What's wrong?"
"Too much wine at lunch. I nearly threw up in the launch."
"You want to go to the restroom?"
"Can you take me, Jean-Michel?"
Jean-Michel nodded and stood up.
"Wait," Monique said. "I've come with you."
Jean-Michel shook his head, but Monique stood abruptly and helped Sarah to her feet.
"The poor girl's sick," she hissed at him in French. "She needs a woman to look after her."
At that same moment, a Suzuki Vitara pulled into the parking lot of Le Tetu. Yossi was behind the wheel. Yakov and Lavon were seated in back. Yakov chambered the first round in his 9mm Beretta, then peered down the passage and waited for Sarah to appear. Sarah glanced over her shoulder as they left the beach and saw Zizi and Nadia staring at her. She turned and looked straight ahead. Jean-Michel was on her left, Monique on her right. Each held an arm. They led her quickly through the interior portion of the restaurant and past the boutique. The passageway was in heavy shadow. Jean-Michel opened the door of the ladies' room and switched on the light, then looked quickly around and gestured for Sarah to enter. The door slammed shut. Too hard, she thought. She locked it securely and looked in the mirror. The face staring back at her was no longer hers. It might have been painted by Max Beckmann or Edvard Munch, or perhaps Gabriel's grandfather, Viktor Frankl. A portrait of a terrified woman. Through the closed door, she heard the voice of Monique asking if she was all right. Sarah braced herself on the sink, then closed her eyes and waited.
Shit, murmured Yakov. Why did she have to bring the fucking kickboxer?
Can you take him? Asked Lavon.
I think so, but if things start to go badly out there, make sure you shoot him in the head.
I've never shot anyone in my life.
It's easy, Yakov said. Put your finger on the trigger and pull.
It was precisely 8:32 p.m. when Gabriel mounted the wooden stairs on the beach at Marigo Bay. He wore a motorcycle helmet with a dark visor, and beneath the helmet a lip microphone and miniature earpiece. The black nylon rucksack containing the Berettas was secured to his back by the shoulder straps. Mikhail, one step behind him, was identically attired. They climbed aboard the motorbikes and fired the engines simultaneously. Gabriel nodded his head once, and together they accelerated into the empty road. They plunged down a steep hill, Gabriel leading the way, Mikhail a few yards behind. The road was narrow and bordered on both sides by a stone wall. Ahead of them, at the top of another hill, was the turnoff for Point Milou. Parked along the edge of the stone wall was a motorcycle, and sitting astride the saddle, wearing blue jeans and a tight-fitting shirt, was Ramona, her face concealed by a helmet and visor. She flashed her headlamp twice, the signal that the road was clear. Gabriel and Mikhail took the corner at speed, leaning hard through the turn and sped out onto the point. The sea opened before them, luminous in the moonlight. To their left rose the slope of a barren hillside. On their right stood a row of small cottages. A black dog emerged from the last cottage and barked savagely as they swept past. At the next intersection was a kiosk of postboxes and a small, unoccupied bus shelter. An approaching car rounded the corner too fast and strayed into Gabriel's side of the road. He slowed and waited for it to pass, then opened the throttle again. It was then he heard the voice of Ramona in his ear.
We have a problem, she said calmly.
Gabriel, as he made the turn, glanced over his shoulder and saw what it was. They were being followed by a battered blue Range Rover with gendarmerie markings. In the parking lot of Le Tetu, Yakov was reaching for the door latch when he heard Ramona in his earpiece. He looked at Lavon and asked,
What the fuck is going on?
It was Gabriel who told him. There were two gendarmes in the Rover, one behind the wheel and a second, more senior-looking man in the passenger seat with a radio handset pressed to his lips. Gabriel resisted the temptation to turn around for a second look and kept his eyes straight ahead. Just beyond the bus shelter, the road forked. Bin Shafiq's villa lay to the right. Gabriel and Mikhail went left. A few seconds later, they slowed and looked behind them. The gendarmes had gone the other way. Gabriel braked to a halt and debated what to do next. Were the gendarmes on a routine patrol, or were they responding to a call of some sort? Was it merely bad luck, or something more? He was certain of only one thing. Ahmed bin Shafiq was within his grasp, and Gabriel wanted him dead. He turned around, rode back to the fork, and looked toward the end of the point. The road was clear, and the gendarmes were nowhere in sight. He twisted the throttle and plunged forward through the darkness. When he arrived at the villa, he found the security gate open and the gendarmerie Range Rover parked in the drive. Ahmed bin Shafiq, the most dangerous terrorist in the world, was loading his suitcases into the back of his Subaru. And the two French policemen were helping him. Gabriel rode back to the spot where Mikhail was waiting and broke the news to the entire team simultaneously.
Our friend is about to leave the island, and Zizi's arranged a police escort.
Are we blown? Mikhail asked.
We have to assume that's the case. Take Sarah and get over to Celine.
I'm afraid that's no longer possible, Lavon said.
What's not possible?
We can't get Sarah,
he said.
We're losing her.
A fist crashed against the door 3 times. A tense voice shouted at her to come out. Sarah turned the latch and opened the door. Jean-Michel was standing outside in the passage along with 4 of Zizi's bodyguards. They seized her arms and pulled her back to the beach. The white cabriolet came through the security gate and turned onto the road, followed by the police rover. 15 seconds later, the little convoy sped past Gabriel and Mikhail. The top of the convertible was still down. Bin Shafiq had both hands on the wheel, and his eyes were straight ahead. Gabriel looked at Mikhail and spoke to the entire team simultaneously over the radio. Evacuate to Saline now, everyone. Leave me a boat, but get off the island. Then he set off after Bin Shafiq and the gendarmes.
You're hurting me.
I'm sorry, Miss Sarah, but we have to hurry.
For what, the main course?
There's been a bomb threat. We're leaving the island.
A bomb threat? Against who? Against what?
Please don't say another word, Miss Sarah. Just walk quickly.
I will, but let go of my arms. You're hurting me.
Gabriel stayed 200 yards behind the Range Rover and rode with his headlamp doused. They sped through the village of Lorient, then Saint-Jean. As they raced along the edge of the bay, he saw the sign for Le Tetou. He throttled down and peered into the parking lot just as Zizi and the rest of his entourage were climbing into the land cruisers under the gaze of 2 more gendarmes. Sarah was sandwiched between Rafik and Jean-Michel. There was nothing Gabriel could do now. Reluctantly, he accelerated and set off after Bin Shafiq. The airport was now directly ahead of them. Without warning, the 2 vehicles swerved into the service road and headed through an open security gate onto the tarmac. A turboprop was waiting at the end of the tarmac, engines running. Gabriel stopped on the shoulder of the road and watched as Bin Shafiq, the woman, and the 2 gendarmes emerged from their vehicles. The Saudi terrorist and the woman immediately boarded the plane, while the gendarmes loaded the bags into the storage compartment in the belly. 15 seconds after the cabin door closed, the plane lurched forward and swept down the runway. As it rose over the Baie de Saint-Jean, Zizi's motorcade came roaring past in a black blur and started up the hill toward Gustavia. It was 8:40 when Mordecai and Oded spotted Mikhail and Ramona clambering down the dunes toward Saline Beach. 2 minutes later, 4 more figures appeared. By 8:43, everyone was aboard the boats but Lavon.
You heard him, Ali, Yakov shouted. He wants everyone off the island.
I know, Lavon said, but I'm not leaving without him.
Yakov could see there was no point in arguing. A moment later, the Zodiacs were bounding through the surf toward Sundancer. Lavon watched them melt into the darkness. Then he turned and began pacing the water's edge, waiting for Gabriel. The motorcade snaked its way at high speed down the hill into Gustavia. Gabriel, following after them, could see Alexandra ablaze with light at the edge of the harbor. 2 minutes later, the land cruisers turned into the parking lot of the marina. Zizi's bodyguards handled the disembarkation and loading process with the speed and precision of professionally trained men. Rescue was not an option. Gabriel saw her only once, a flash of saffron wedged between 2 large dark figures. And a moment later, they were seaborne once more, bound for the sanctuary of Alexandra. He had no choice but to turn and head to Saline. Lavon had already started the outboard of the Zodiac. Gabriel sat morosely in the prow as they headed into the bay.
Do you remember what I told you this afternoon, Gabriel?
I remember, Ellie.
If you can get only 1 target tonight, make sure it's Sarah. That's what I told you.
I know, Ellie.
Who made the mistake? Was it us or was it Sarah?
Doesn't matter now.
No, it doesn't. He's going to kill her, unless we can somehow get her back.
He won't do it here, not after involving the French police.
He'll find a way. No one betrays Zizi and gets away with it. Zizi's rules.
He'll have to move her, Gabriel said. And of course he'll want to know who she's working for.
Which means we might have a very small window, depending on the method Zizi is willing to use to get answers.
Gabriel was silent. Lavon could read his thoughts.
We'll get her, Gabriel was thinking. Let's just hope there's something left of her when we do.
Chapter 28, CIA Headquarters. Word of the disaster in San Bartolomé arrived in the operations room at King Saul Boulevard within 10 minutes of Gabriel's return to Sundancer. Amos Charette, the Director General, was upstairs in his office at the time and was informed of the developments by the duty officer. Despite the lateness of the hour, he immediately woke the Prime Minister and told him the news. 5 minutes later, there was a second secure call from Sundancer, this one to Langley, Virginia. It went not to the ops center, but to the private line of Adrian Carter's seventh-floor office. Carter took the news calmly, as he did most things, and toyed with a stray paperclip as Gabriel made his request. "We have a plane in Miami at the moment," Carter said. "It can be on the ground in St. Martin by dawn." Carter hung up the phone and gazed toward the bank of television monitors on the opposite side of the room. The President was in Europe on his fence-mending tour. He had spent the day meeting with the new German Chancellor, while outside the police had waged running street battles across Berlin with anti-American demonstrators. More of the same was expected at the President's final two stops, Paris and Rome. The French were bracing for a wave of Muslim rioting, and the Carabinieri were anticipating demonstrations on a scale not seen in the Italian capital in a generation. Hardly the scenes of transatlantic harmony the White House image makers had been hoping for. Carter switched off the television and locked his papers in his wall safe, then took his overcoat from the hook on the back of his door and slipped out.
This is the end of disc number 7. Please insert disc number 8.